It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here with the latest security news and something he's promised for a while, a look at the security behind the new mega upload service. How safe, how secure is it despite all their protestations? Maybe not as secure as you might have thought. Steve explains all next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
It's time for Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 390, recorded February 6, 2013. Mega Security. Time for Security Now, the show, as I wave my finger, the show that brings you and your loved ones peace of mind, thanks to this fella right here, the explainer-in-chief, our security guru, Mr. Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
That would be me, Leo.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes, our non-live listeners have been spared 36 minutes of nonsense.
It's not nonsense.
No, in fact, I've nonsense. Actually... I've received some tweets during this saying, this is why I tune in and listen live.
Always it's, listen
you know,
live.
LOL.
You it's never absurd. Know. You know, we talk about coffee, science fiction. Basically, I try to have the conversation. See, you don't. People may not know, but this is you and I only really get to talk once a week. So this is our personal time.
Oh, I miss our quiet private
this
dinners.
This is our personal time. So we like to have a little time to catch up, see how we're each is doing, and, you know, fill them in on the gossip.
Boxes or briefs. Yeah.
So, hello. I guess you've been kind of busy, a little busy this week.
I've been super busy, yes. We have lots of news. Today, as promised, we've got an overview of the security and lack of Kim.com's new mega cloud storage offering.
Oh, great.
Some of the attacks have been a little overblown, but it also demonstrates that they've got a ways to go. And it's a perfect example of why this stuff should all be done in the open.
Yeah.
A consequence of the fact that their initial client, their only client at this point, is a browser, is that their tech is in JavaScript, which automatically means it's open for analysis. And oh boy, that was a good thing because they've got a lot of work to do. So we're going to talk about that and catch up on other news of the week. There was a really unbelievable article in Slate about a new iOS app called Silent Circle that I want to talk about. But I first want to follow up on last week's universal plug-and-play nightmare revelation. Well, our listeners will remember that on Tuesday, the day before last week's podcast, H.D. Moore of Rapid7 surprised the world with their report on the number of open and exposed universal plug-and-play ports on the world's routers. 2.2% of the entire addressable IPv4 space. So that's 2.2% of 4.3 billion, which was 81 million different devices responded. And as a consequence of that, I said that I would immediately add a test for this to Shields Up. So all of our listeners who don't already know, I did tweet this Thursday afternoon, late afternoon. It took me all of Thursday to write it. And actually, when I went, I hadn't looked at this code for 10 years, but that was the rewrite of the original Shields Up system, where I added the concept of true stealth, where I was looking for any noise coming back from an IP that we were testing. And I rewrote the foundation with the experience from the first one, and I was frankly quite pleased when I looked at it last Thursday. It's like, oh, this is pretty nice. And so I was already checking for NetBIOS ports, which is a UDP packet where I care about the return data. So I was pretty much able to copy the logic that I had developed and proven there for the universal plug-and-play probe. Anyway, so just anyone and everyone actually should go to GRC.com, go to the regular Shields Up entry point, and you'll see a big clickable icon says, whatever it says, you know, GRC's instant UPnP exposure test or something like that, and it just takes a few seconds, you can get three different outcomes. You are either completely invisible or you are actively denying probes or you're accepting them. And in fact, because I had a couple of members of the press had asked me what would it look like if I was exposed, on that same page down below, I have three links to samples of the three different outcomes so people can see what they look like. I also, on that page, Leo, link to the podcast that we did last Wednesday, which was, you know, the whole beginning of it was about this. So I link to the YouTube instance of it for anybody who wants to see it, and also to the audio. So what we have found is, to date, 780 different individual people that have come by have been exposed. Several people reported the rejected response. I didn't even know if that was possible, but it was available to me. So I built in that possibility of being actively rejected. The idea being that when you send a UDP packet at the port, you get back an ICMP packet that says destination unreachable. So it's an affirmative, there's nobody here. So you're not stealth, but at the same time, you're also not vulnerable to a universal plug-and-play exposure. And then, of course, if you do respond, I show on the page of the block of text which comes back, which has all the details about the version of Linux that you're running, the version of the universal plug-and-play code that you're running, the port that the device is listening on for future conversations. I don't go to the next step of then establishing an HTTP TCP connection to that port. I could have, but my feeling is, hey, you don't want any exposure anyway, so there's really no point in showing people more of what's there. The fact that anything is there is not good. So the other interesting thing that I found is immediately upon finishing the podcast, I set up my own little honeypot net. I have a block of 64 IPs here that have never been used for almost anything. They get like just debris traffic in, just the noise that's on the internet. But I left the machine on. I unbound the IPv4 TCP protocol so that it became protocol free, because I had to put it directly on the internet with no firewall. And then I hooked up the network. It's a cool thing. I don't know if people know that when you're using Wireshark, you can, in the same way that years ago in Shields Up, I showed people how to unbind protocols, you can unbind your IPv4 and IPv6 protocol stack from the interface so that you are completely invulnerable. You're an adapter listening promiscuously, but it doesn't matter that you're now on the internet, as long as you're careful, because you have no protocol essentially listening to that wire. It's just a raw Ethernet cable, and Wireshark is still able to pick up packets. And the point is that I then built a filter looking for anything incoming on UDP protocol and port 119. I have so far, so it's been about a week, found 21 unique IPs out on the internet that have sent UDP port 119, I mean 1900 is what I mean to say, 1900 incoming packets to this block of 64 IPs. Several of the IPs have been scanning. They sort of scan in a pseudo-random order. They don't come back that often. Several others are doing a much slower scan. I should mention that every day a couple new ones appear that I have not seen before. So this is exactly what we would expect if hackers were beginning to come up to speed about this vulnerability and deciding that they're going to start having some fun with this. So this is not a theoretical concern. There are definitely unknown entities out on the net. I've tried to look up some of these IPs and gotten nowhere. They're just like, there's no records of them anywhere. So the first ones that I saw were in Amazon's scalable network architecture system. It's like, whoa, that's interesting. So somebody was apparently using Amazon as their scanning hub, you know, basically rent some machine and some bandwidth from Amazon and scan the net for universal plug-and-play vulnerabilities. Anyway, the test exists, and people have been surprised and turning them off. I did just see a tweet saying that a new version of the mini UPnP, I think it was version 1.6, the tweet said, had just been released. That doesn't help end users because we're not able to update our firmware ourselves, but it does make the packages available to the manufacturers. And hopefully this has been a big enough wake-up call that we'll get some firmware updates and close these things. So that's what's been going on there.
Thanks for doing that. I know everybody was dying to test their routers. I'm amazed at the number of issues, although in some ways that seems like a lower number than one would expect given how many routers are vulnerable.
You mean like the number I'm seeing or the incoming? Well, these are only, you know,
there's Security Now listeners, for one thing.
Yes, exactly.
Not that there's anything we can do about it, really, is there?
Well, no. I mean, all you can,
buy a new router.
Most routers have universal plug and play on by default.
Right.
If you're not a gamer, I think that's about it. If you're not a gamer, you should turn it off.
Right.
Now, but even if it's on inside your network, it may not be on outside your network. And that's the only danger. So that's what I'm testing for, is whether it's exposed to the public.
And it's not possible, if I've turned it off internally, that this flaw that we're talking about could still give an external attacker.
Yes,
that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm thinking is that, anybody listening to this show has certainly disabled UPnP years ago.
We have confirmed that there are some routers that leave it on outside, even if it's off inside, and some that don't actually turn it off inside. That's just a checkbox.
Just like
it's
the
not hooked up to anything.
It's like the WPS flaw, which links us, has a checkbox that says turn off WPS that does nothing. It's nice to put those in the UI because it gives people, reassures people.
Oh, yes. And also, it's right it's above the one that says, I'd like to have no problems. And you can just check that.
It reminds me of the security theater that we go through as we go through airports. It's to make you feel better. It doesn't actually. You know, it was interesting as we were leaving New Orleans because
it just airs out your socks, basically.
Yeah. As we're leaving New Orleans because it was such a flood of people the day after the Super Bowl.
I couldn't even imagine.
No. This was what surprised me. They turned off security. We did not take off our shoes. We did not take out our laptops. They took off the millimeter scans. All we had to do was go through a metal detector.
Nice. Just like the old days.
It was just like the old days. And I thought,
yeah.
But wait a minute. Wasn't it important that we took our shoes off? Wasn't it important that we took our laptops out?
No. See, the bomb would have gone...
it's irrelevant.
Would have been during the game, not after the game. So,
clearly I see.
That didn't happen. Incoming, you're going to have security. Outgoing, maybe the fuse didn't work.
Security theater. It's everywhere, friends. It's everywhere.
Yes, it is. So, I did get some breathless tweets about the so-called Lucky 13 attack on SSL. It made some news that there was a new compromise on SSL. And I thought, okay, what do we have now? Okay, so the short version is there's nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. Quoting from the paper from people who I guess really needed a PhD, they said, we've discovered a variety of attacks, each having different complexity and severity. For TLS, our attacks are multi-session attacks, and they're not kidding when they say multi-session. We'll cover that in a second, which means that we require the target plain text to be repeatedly sent in the same position in the plain text stream in multiple TLS sessions. Okay, so let's stop there. That means that they need essentially the same stuff to be sent unmodified over and over and over again. Okay, so, okay, well, maybe that could be bad. The attacks involve detecting small differences in the time at which TLS error messages are returned on the network in response to attacker-generated ciphertexts. Okay, so this is a timing-based vulnerability, such as it is, where they're messing things up on purpose as this data is going by, and they're seeing how long it takes to have an acknowledgement of the thing that they broke, and they're detecting slight differences in the time to respond, which means that the algorithms at the receiving end differ depending upon the way they break the text. So this is a classic side channel attack on crypto. They said, because of network jitter and other effects, the times observed by the attacker are noisy, meaning that even if they weren't doing anything wrong, they're still going to get varying timing attacks. So they say, and multiple samples, and they're not kidding, of each time are needed to make the attacks reliable. That is, they need huge numbers of samples, which are themselves going to carry jitter in order to filter out, essentially, the native jitter in the network. So they say, in their simplest form, our attacks can reliably recover a complete block of TLS encrypted plaintext. Now, let's remember, that's a cipher block, which means that's 128 bits or 16 bytes. So they can recover 16 bytes of the encrypted plaintext using about 2 to the 23 TLS sessions.
How many? That's a lot.
That's 8.4 million. So
take a little time.
That, well, and remember, they have to have somebody.
There's a sin in an act.
Well, no. This is they have to have exactly the same match. Packet
right.
Pass by
right.
8.4 million times.
But then. Then I got you.
Exactly. Then we figured out 16 bytes. Okay.
So okay, I'm not too worried.
Assuming we can all breathe a sigh of relief. Assuming the attacker is located on the same LAN as the machine being attacked. Because, Leo, forget the internet.
Right.
Talk about delays and jitter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and buffering and all that nonsense. So this only works if you're next to the computer,
yeah,
whose data you're trying to decrypt.
Although with Wi-Fi, you could be on the same.
No, I don't know if Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi might introduce too much jitter. I mean, this has got to be, you know, you can't use a tin can and string with this. This has got to be, I mean, they're looking at something incredibly subtle. So they said assuming the attacker is located on the same LAN as the machine being attacked, and HMAC SHA-1 is used as TLS's MAC algorithm, and of course, that's one of many that might be used, this can be reduced to 2 to the 19 TLS sessions if the plain text is known to be base 64 encoded, which means that the character set only contains a subset of the total number of bytes. Remember that a byte is 256 bits. That gives us 256 different combinations per byte. But if you happen to know that the plain text was base 64 encoded, then you would know that the bytes were only going to be one of 64 values, you know, uppercase, lowercase, alpha, and then plus and minus. If you knew that, then you can do it in only 219, two to the 19th sessions.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Anyway, me in the chat room says it'd be easier just to look over the guy's shoulder, to be honest.
Or just hit him on the head.
Clonk him.
Yeah. So, but it is true, and we have to acknowledge this. Bruce Schneier was right when he said, prophetically and correctly, attacks only get better, they never get worse. So, no one is taking this lightly. And all of the SSL packages in the industry have just been updated. There's a new open SSL, both the 0.9.8 track, I think went from V to Z, and GNU SSL and CYA SSL, all of them. Oh, and the NSS, the Mozilla Netscape Security Suite, that's in the process of being updated. The only things unaffected are those that are using hardware, like the F5 router technology is got it all in hardware, so there is no timing variation from that. So what has been done is tiny modifications were made to the code so that they're looking at what the probes were, and they're doing something to the code to make them homogeneous in terms of time response. The error messages they generate all take the same amount of time. So small change in code, and it's like, okay, good, you know, got us. So now this is fixed. So the good news is TLS is really standing up very well. And in their own overview, they said, is it still safe to use TLS so that we don't all hyperventilate at once? They wrote, and the people who figured this out wrote, the attacks can only be carried out by a determined attacker who is located close to the machine being attacked and who can generate sufficient sessions for the attacks, 8.4 million. In this sense, the attacks do not pose a significant danger to ordinary users of TLS in their current form. However, it is a truism that attacks only get better with time, and we cannot anticipate what improvements to our attacks or entirely new attacks may yet be discovered. In addition, because of its extremely widespread use, any attack against TLS requires careful evaluation. In this context, it is notable that the leading TLS implementations are deploying countermeasures to our attacks. And it is true that everybody has said, okay, well, you know, we can't be odd man out here, so we're all going to update ourselves.
I think that's actually great. It shows that they take it very seriously, even though it's not really a serious security issue.
Yeah, and really look at the difference here. Instantaneous updates across the industry
to
something that you can barely find it in a clear day.
Right.
And yet here we have routers that have been massively, you know, miscoded and pumped out
from the router companies. Not a word. Not an acknowledgement. Not anything.
And remember, they have a liability concern too. Their attorneys are like in a sweat right now, because if anything happened to somebody,
is what they're saying, admit nothing.
Exactly. Now, okay, probably the most tweets I've seen in a long time came from an article in Slate on a new product for iOS called Silent Circle. I don't know what the Silent Circle people are paying their PR agency, but it's not enough.
I don't think they have a PR agency.
Oh, somebody does.
What is it?
I don't. This was an unbelievable article. The title was "The Threat of Silence," and the subtitle was "Meet the groundbreaking new encryption app set to revolutionize privacy and freak out the feds."
Wow.
Leo, governments are going to crumble.
Oh, my God.
Life as we know it, forget it.
Holy cow.
It's all changed.
How could it be?
They even have, as their CEO, a 45-year-old former Navy SEAL commando.
There you go.
On the team, Leo.
So I think that's good training for you know, writing security software.
The article that in Slate, I mean, it sounds like this thing is God's gift. It is. The piece that was written is more impressive than the software. The software is nice. What the software does is provide point-to-point crypto between two iOS devices. And you can burn the file at either end. Subject, of course, to problems with deleting things from flash memory, which we understand is problematical.
Yeah.
I don't mean to put this down. at all. I think, you know, and but the article is just amazing. They talk about all these case studies of people in the Middle East. Someone, you know, used it to videotape something bad happening, and then used Silent Circle to beam it off to Europe over their secure link, and then burned it from their phone so that, you know, after they were captured, you know, even Navy SEAL commandos couldn't determine what it was that they had video recorded. Anyway,
That's nice.
A UI on crypto is important. I mean, that's a lot of what I was aiming at when I was looking at doing my own VPN, you know, that I named CryptoLink, was the idea that it would be incredibly simple to use. The reason I stopped doing the notes on how to set up OpenVPN was that, you know, I made it work, like with multiple simultaneous listening ports so that you could always get to it, but it was an incredible nightmare.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I'm just going to solve this problem. So there's definitely a need for a very secure, turnkey, point-to-point app for iOS. And now we have one. So, announcing Silent Circle. And if you want a real thrill to run up your leg, go find the Slate article titled The Threat of Silence. And you'll know what this thing can do for you, because it's quite impressive.
You're mocking it a little bit.
Yeah, I am. I'm just the piece. Just no. I think the app is probably really good. I think the guys who are behind it, they really know their crypto. So I believe it's been done right. I trust it.
Unfortunately, it's closed source. I can't trust any crypto that's not open source.
Yeah, but it's like Zimmerman of you know. I mean, he's one of the guys. I think maybe I'm confusing stories, but
Phil,
I think
Phil
it was,
Zimmerman is involved with it.
I think he is
the PGP guy.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, they know their crypto, and I believe they got it right. And that's the other thing too. It's not hard to do it. It's not hard to do this right. It is a store and forward service, so that, you know, and it's a trust no one technology, so that it's being encrypted locally, and that they're holding it, but they cannot break the crypto.
So what it says here is it utilizes Phil Zimmerman's open source ERTP encryption protocol.
Ah, okay, good. I'm glad you clarified that.
But that we have to take their, unless something's open source, we have to take their word for it. So the problem I have is that because it's iOS software, it's always closed source.
Yeah,
you have to trust the company. I mean,
and remember too that BlackBerry had a lot of problem, or RIM, I guess they're now called BlackBerry officially. RIM had a lot of problem in the Middle East last year because the governments there were deciding we don't like not being able to see into
so they opened the track.
Yes, and so the problem is, you know, what do we do here? You know, they're making a lot of noise about the fact that this is uncrackable. The fact is, everybody's encryption is uncrackable. You just may not be able to use it,
right?
Because, you know, the government will say no, or someone will put some pressure on Apple and they'll remove it from the App Store and it'll vaporize off of everyone's iOS devices, because we know Apple has the ability to do that too.
See, that's why I like TrueCrypt, because you can validate it. You can say, hey, it's working. I know what it's doing.
Yeah.
You can't do that with this. And so you don't know if there's a government backdoor.
Yes.
You'll never know.
For our listeners, you know, just using AxeCrypt or one of the nice little, I mean, crypt is not hard anymore. This problem we've solved. You encrypt the file and you send it to somebody.
On iOS, it's hard. I don't know if there's a way to do it.
Yeah, and so this is a nice platform. So for our listeners, to be serious, I don't mean to put these guys down, but oh my God, the Slate article is just
not
amazing.
Cheap, by the way.
It's $20 a month for each endpoint. So you have to have it, and the other person at the other end has to have it. And so that's $240 a year.
Yeah,
for the privilege. So if you need to be shuttling secure documents around and video footage and images and so forth, this is the right app for it.
There are apps for iOS for many of the other services that we have already talked about that use encryption. I think there's probably ways to do this without spending that much money.
Yeah. And there will be a client, doubtless, for Mega before long.
Look
up there. Yeah. Okay, so there was. This is under the category of why bother. But I do thank the person who tweeted this to me, There is a petition now at the change.org petitions site titled, it's aimed at Oracle Corporation. It's a petition to ask them to stop bundling the Ask toolbar.
Thank you.
With the Java installer.
Thank you.
And again, it's like, yeah, well, okay. I guess it's like asking a mass murderer to be a little less sloppy. You know, please clean up your mess afterwards.
I mean, it's a start.
So if anyone's interested, I guess I could tweet this. I mean, I just looked at that and thought, well, okay, let's just have Java go away, please. You know, it's the number one language, though, Leo. I mean, it's what you have to program. They're teaching it in high school. I have
my kids' high school teaches it, and it's not. It was not my recommendation. It's actually a fairly poor teaching language, but it's practical, I guess.
It's way too complex for
I'd much rather see a scripting language like Python or Ruby being taught, or better yet, even Lisp. But everybody laughs at me when I say that. So.
Yeah, don't say that. I'm public. Yeah. Besides, they'll just think you can't pronounce.
Okay. You know, I was talking to the guy who founded Reddit. Reddit was originally written in Lisp.
Lisp?
Yeah. But they changed that very quickly to Python. I'm sorry.
I had a good friend in high school who actually had a Lisp, and unfortunately her name is Leslie.
Leslie?
And so it was really sad. She said Leslie. But it's like, well, okay.
But she was a hell of a Lisp programmer.
She was.
Yeah.
So in our acronym soup section, we have the acronym for UPnP. Remember, we did our various car acronyms, and Java was just another vulnerability announcement. So UPnP, the best one I've seen was, you're probably not protected.
So, winner! Winner, winner.
Chicken probably dinner. Not protected.
You're probably not protected.
And I did have a nice note from Ron Finney. Oh, and I have a big apology, too. I'll do the apology after the note to our listeners, many of whom I upset. And Ron's note about SpinRite reminded me of my need to apologize. He says, the subject was SpinRite testimony. And he said, he sent this on the 12th of January. He said, I'm a commercial video producer. I had a devastating turn of events. I caught my foot on the power cord to an external 3 terabyte drive, and it crashed to the floor.
That's horrible.
Just look around you for cord, Leo.
Yeah. No, there's no cord there.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. No. Oh, so you got a basement. You just drilled straight down.
Put holes in the floor. The cords are all downstairs.
That's wonderful. Anyway, he says, the drive is history. But then the next day, a large primary internal hard drive began to fail. There went my redundancy.
Uh-oh.
I was getting error notifications upon boot up that the drive was failing. I immediately began attempts to back up the data, but the drive and Windows Explorer would seize up after only transferring one or two files. And when it would transfer, it was extremely slow. I went a whole day and got virtually nowhere. Late in the evening, I got SpinRite. Files started copying, and it is copying almost without a glitch if I don't try to move the files all at once. I am so relieved. I was certain this 3-year-old drive was toast. The product, your product, retrieved irreplaceable files and important video footage that would have taken days to hunt down and recapture from digital tape. Thanks for a great product, Ron Finney, owner, Northwoods Productions in Gig Harbor, Washington. So thank you, Ron, for sharing your success story. And my apology to the people whom I offended.
What?
Unintentionally. Oh, yes.
No.
When I mentioned, I glibly said that nobody has gigs of data on of their own creation on their drives. This was a couple months ago. We were talking about backing up, you know, like the need to back up gigs of data. And I said, you know, who creates that kind of content? Well,
lots of people.
Many people took umbrage at that.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, I'm talking to somebody who's over in Driveland.
Yeah, I didn't take umbrage, but...
No, you know what I meant.
I'd like to move to umbrage. Right next to Gehava. All right. No, yeah. Of course we know. But, you know, you really... the truth is you wouldn't back up that much data. It'd be foolish because, you know, it would take an impossible amount of time unless you had virtually unlimited bandwidth.
But that's, I do recognize the people who are shutter bugs, who are, like generating photos
mostly,
like crazy.
Mostly videographers.
But mostly video people. Yeah. And those are the people who tweeted back saying, hey, I've got, you know, terabytes. So I thought, okay, fine. But sorry.
Yeah. I don't know if we were talking about online backup when we were talking about that. But
we were, actually.
Yeah, because that's crazy. Because if you just do the math, even if you have a megabit, let's see, we can do it in our heads. It's so easy.
The math makes that TLS vulnerability look feasible, yeah.
But if you had, let's say you had 5 megabits. Let's say you could do a megabyte a second. It's just do the math. You could see it. Anything more than a few hundred gigabytes is ridiculous.
That'd be a million of those, yes.
Yeah. A million seconds. How many million seconds is that?
Yeah.
How many is a million seconds? It's a, you know, long time.
That's a lot.
All right, Steve, let's talk. MegaUpload.com.
I first have to mention that since I gave the more clear and thorough explanation of the universal plug-and-play vulnerability, Shields Up did get another big hit of visitors. That's after the hit that we got from our live audience before we started
recording.
Just
now
this.
We got a big hit.
7 more vulnerabilities were found among our live listeners.
Wow.
Yes.
And those people are no longer listening as they rush to buy new routers.
It's like, oh, my God. Yes.
And, well, as long as we're doing follow-ups, I might also mention that, and thanks to Web0213, Phil Zimmerman is indeed one of the founders of Silent Circle. Phil, of course, the creator of PGP.
Did think he was. Yes, yeah. Good.
So they not only use his protocol. I tell you, that reassured me considerably because I know Phil.
Yep.
I trust Phil. He's the president and co-founder along with Mike Janke. So in that case, I would say absolutely.
No, I really think it's the real deal. I just think that their PR firm needs to like be taken out to a huge, wonderful, expensive dinner.
Well,
because that Slate article is just over the top wonderful.
And I know that Phil, in fact, is a little sensitive about what some of the criticisms people have that encryption can be used to defeat law enforcement and government. He would not want, I don't think he would want that kind of coverage. I think he knows that that's a sensitive issue with encryption. And he's, you know.
Well, and at the end of the article, the interviewer asks the CEO, well, what will happen? I think the CEO volunteers that, you know, if it turns out the governments are unhappy with us, we'll just go somewhere where the laws are less restrictive.
Oh, that's good.
It's like, okay, and Apple's going to follow you there?
Mm. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah. Anyway,
okay.
Let's
mega security overview. We know this is about Kim.com, who, as I understand it, Leo, changed his last name.
Yeah, he's German. His real name is, I think, Kim Schmitz.
Yeah.
And he is quite the promoter. He's a little bit, you know, he's got a kind of, I don't want to say shady past, but an interesting past.
Yeah.
And has been in trouble with the law before. He created a service called Mega Upload, and it was widely used for a variety of things, kind of like Dropbox. It turned out that it was apparently widely used for piracy. Some say partly because of the way it was structured. Mega Upload always said, no, we don't encourage piracy. Nevertheless, the United States government decided it was, seized their servers in the U.S., and managed to get the New Zealand government to arrest Kim.com.
Did they extradite or just arrest him there?
They have not extradited him. He is, as far as I know, he's wandering around New Zealand.
Yeah, because the DOJ did try to extradite him.
Charges have not been dropped, and it is not over yet on Mega Upload. However, he went out, raised more money, and by the way, a lot of people are very upset about the seizure of Mega Upload servers because they were using it for business documents and other purposes and have lost all their data that was stored there.
Uh-huh.
So it's not completely piracy, anyway. So he started, and there's more, much more to the story, but he started a new company a couple of weeks ago on the anniversary of the seizure of MegaUpload.com.
Well, and therein lies a bit of a story.
Uh-huh.
Because it looks like they were in a bit of a hurry. I think it was clear that there was schedule pressure for the release of this on the anniversary of the raid, which was what he did.
Yeah.
But a bunch of people have looked at the code, as have I, and after I I got recovered from looking at it.
Really?
Oh, goodness, yes.
There's a lot of interest because it's got 50 gigs of free storage to start, right?
Yeah, but, well, yes. And
they're billing themselves the privacy company.
Yeah, their own documentation states that they know the JavaScript is a mess, that it's not commented, it's poorly formatted, it needs work, and I know you're sitting down, but don't puncture your ball, Leo. This is their first JavaScript project.
Their first ever.
Yes. Yes, this is the first JavaScript they've written, and
oh,
it does show, unfortunately.
Oh,
now,
so wait a minute. So the encryption and everything is client side?
Yes, and that it is. It attempts to be a TNO system, trust no one system, and that's the benefit. Now, many people have commented that it is a benefit to them more than it is a benefit to us. I don't quite follow that.
Well, they're not going to get arrested, maybe.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here. So, the first is that they're using the browser as their client.
Right.
So that's a problem. It is the case that they apparently have a very nice back end, and the API is open, and I am sure we will see people developing clients to use the mega system natively rather than through the browser. But the only client that exists today is the browser. So the browser
that's what's in JavaScript, not the back end.
Correct.
We don't know.
The backend is closed. We don't know. But the good news is the worst that they could do, well, it's not quite true. I was going to say the worst that they could do is to lose your data, but that's not exactly true. Because they are also doing file deduplication.
Wait a minute. How do they do that if it's trust no one?
Turns out it's possible to do that. There's something called convergent cryptography.
We talked about that a couple of episodes ago.
And the idea is if you have a file and you hash it to get the key which you use to encrypt it, then only someone who had the file has the key because they had to have the file to hash it to get the key.
Right.
And that means that anybody else that had the same file independently hashed it would get the same key. So the idea is when you send this up there to the cloud sees, oh, look, we've already got the same file with the same hash, so we're not going to store it again.
But that leaks information. Well, go ahead.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It leaks information that the MPAA would like to have.
Love to know. Because all they do is they upload their movie, get the key, and see who else has done that.
So there is a problem. There's no question that the deduplication only serves the benefit of Mega. Now, a study that Microsoft did in 2003 of 585 workstations showed that 50% benefit could be obtained by doing duplicate elimination among that set of Microsoft's 585 workstations. But, okay, first of all, this was in 2003. So there weren't, like, videos and MP3 files at probably in huge abundance on Microsoft workstations. They were also probably all running Windows, probably the same version. So there was a large substrate of identical stuff. Now, where people are taking pictures, that's original content. Anyone who does an MP3 conversion themselves is probably going to be generating original content from the original digital source. MP3 is a lossy compression, and all the codecs are slightly different and operate in a slightly different fashion. So it's only what I should say is that modern analysis of typical cloud storage only shows a 0.1% benefit from dupe elimination. So what that says to me is it's they if they're bothered to do dupe elimination, which is not a simple thing to do, and it comes at a cost of privacy, they must be gaining a lot from it. And the only way you could gain a lot from it is if many identical huge files are being uploaded. And, of course, those are movies.
Piracy.
Yeah, that's piracy. So that's the only reason I can see that they would still have that in there. But
the hash is not going to be the same unless the file is absolutely identical. In other words,
well, one bit different is half of the bits are different in the hash.
So if I rip a movie and you rip exactly the same movie, that doesn't mean the hashes will be equal. In fact, the chances are very slim that they will be equal.
It's only really going to be identical downloads.
It's the same file.
We both downloaded the same file from BitTorrent.
And then reshared it.
Right. Okay, so Java crypto is challenged in the browser. There are a number of things that are tricky with doing security, good crypto and security in the JavaScript in a browser. For one thing, all of the pieces that come into the page have nominal access to the Java that's running. So you need to control the entire envelope of everything that is there. Also, many JavaScript implementations have known poor random number generators. And this is a big problem for crypto that is purely Java-based. When I was doing the work on the off-the-grid project and I developed that ultra-high entropy program, pseudo-random number generator, the way I solved the problem was that I sent a wad of very good entropy down with the page and then added to that the entropy from the machine and, you know, mouse and keyboard and things, other things that I was able to get. The beauty of that is that you're then not relying just on local entropy, but you're starting with really good entropy, but then you're adding to it so in my case, for example, so that GRC doesn't know anything about the entropy you finally had on your system, because you immediately dumped a bunch from the local machine and, you know, mushed it all together in order to get something new. But it solved that approach, which they're not using, by the way, and they could trivially add, would really help the problem of them using the known limited random number generating capabilities of JavaScript on the browser. Now, another troubling note is, and this comes from the analysis of the script, if you select remember me during your logon, your master key to all of your data is stored unencrypted in the browser's local storage and is written to disk. So that's not good. You don't want to do that. That's an example of some of the limitations, partly of their implementation and partly the fact that they're in the browser and in JavaScript. But the problem is, if you know, we want to have a trust no one technology, but we really never have that if we're using JavaScript, which we dynamically download from them on the fly, because all they have to do is change the JavaScript and it's no longer TNO. Now, what they've done is something interesting. They've got a very good high level 2048-bit public key crypto on their main mega server, mega.co.nz or something. That's got very good crypto. The problem is they can't afford to serve the bulk of their JavaScript from that single server to the world. So they use a content delivery network to provide most of the JavaScript. They have the concept of a chain of trust, which we've talked about often in the context of certificate authorities, where the idea is you download from Mega, the the index.html, which is contains a core of JavaScript and signatures, digital signatures, fingerprints, for all the other files that it then loads from the content delivery network, the CDN network. And the idea is that you trust the core that you get from Mega, and then you trust all of the additional JavaScript code to flesh out the client that is not coming from Mega, but from a geographically distributed CDN, because that core verifies the signature. The problem is they made a mistake in the algorithm that they chose for verifying the signatures. They use an approach called CBC-MAC, Cipher Block Chaining Message Authentication Code. We've talked about cipher block chaining even recently, where the concept is you don't just take 128 bits of plain text and encrypt it to 128 bits of ciphertext, then take the next 128 bits of plain text and encrypt it to the next 128 bits of ciphertext, because that would mean that each block would stand alone and there would be leakage of information. If you ever encrypted the same plain text, you'd always get, under the same key, you'd always get the same ciphertext. So instead, they take the output from the first operation and XOR that, exclusive OR it, with the input to the second operation and so forth, forming a forward-pointing chain. So you can do the same thing in order to verify a file using cipher block chaining, and essentially you feed the file in and chain together all the ciphers and get a result out. The problem is this is known not to be secure for variable length content. That is, if the length cannot change, then this is secure. If you were, for example, if you wanted to use CBC-MAC for 4K clusters, then because they're always 4K, it's secure. You can trust that the code you get will demonstrate that none of the bits in that 4K cluster changed. Any bit changes, it's going to be different. And it is computationally infeasible to make any sort of change that you would want to and also have the MAC come out the same. This only applies, though, for fixed length. The JavaScript that they're loading from the CDN are inherently variable length. And it is trivial, it turns out, to compute whatever MAC message authentication code you wish to have for a block whose content and length you can specify. And so this completely breaks something that in their own documentation they brag about how they've done this in order to protect the code that could otherwise be not under their control in a content delivery network. You know, bad guys could somehow get up to some mischief and change those files on a CDN that they don't have direct oversight over. So they've tried to protect that, and they completely blew it. They blew it badly. It's not at all clear why they did this. I mean, we know how to do message authentication codes. The only thing I can see is they really seem to like the AES cipher. They just use it for everything. And so this is a way of using a symmetric cipher like Rheindahl AES for cipher block chaining to create a message authentication code. But it's, and I should mention, there are safe ways to do it. There's something called a CMAC, an AES CMAC, which is an RFC standard, RFC 4494. So if you wanted to use AES, it can be done. They just didn't do that correctly. Or you use an HMAC, which is a standard hash-based message authentication, to also do it. Those are strong authentication technologies. They just didn't use them. They basically rolled their own, and they rolled it wrong, so that there is no protection at all for the bulk of the JavaScript, which is being loaded into people's browsers when they go to Mega and are trusting what they get.
How would you attack it?
Anybody just changes the JavaScript in the CDN network, you know, through whatever means, and they're able to change the JavaScript and have it authenticate, so that when it is pulled by the client and this root JavaScript that was directly received from Mega, when it runs the message authentication code over the JavaScript, it'll say, oh, this is legal. This is exactly the code that we gave the CDN to give to you.
That's kind of pathetic.
In fact, it is really bad, Leo. It's really bad. Yeah. So it breaks that.
So basically, you could do a man in the middle attack on this, on the JavaScript, replace it with your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And have it completely pass authentication because they authenticated in a completely broken fashion.
Yeah.
They also use.
And you see this, by the way, from the source code. You can look at the source code and say, oh, I see where they blew it.
Yep, exactly. Wow. Yes. And in fact. That means
everybody else has as well.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's worth saying that these are all launch problems.
Right.
I mean,
they can
fix
this quickly.
Yes, this can all be fixed. In fact, there are some things that have already been fixed. So these are, you know, we shouldn't trust amateurs that have never done crypto and are writing the JavaScript for the first time, and coming out of the gate on day one saying everybody use this. They should have not been focused on this anniversary date. No doubt work on the back end took longer than they expected. They didn't get to the front end, you know, in time. This wasn't released to the crypto community for vetting. If it had been, it would have been, you know, torn apart, and they could have, you know, said thank you very much for your input, fixed all these things, and then released something that was solid from day one. Instead, the press had a fiesta this, you know, the last couple weeks, you know, with all of these stories about how broken Mega was, you know, Mega insecurity. Another example is they take the user's password and they try to strengthen the password. We've talked about how that's done. It's by iterating. We've talked about PBKDF2, password-based key derivation function. We've talked about just 2 weeks ago when we were talking about memory hard functions used by Scrypt to deliberately make something slow. What these guys did was they used an unsalted AES loop. So they take the password from the user and they convert it into the block size of AES, and then with a fixed password so that everybody in the world uses the same. Oh, I'm sorry, with a fixed key for AES, they then run AES on itself, 16,364, I've lost my powers of two, 8192, 16384, 16,384 times. So basically they take the output of that, of one, put it right back in and re-encrypt it again, re-encrypt it again, re-encrypt it again, re-encrypt it again. The problem, okay, so there's several problems. First of all, AES is so popular that it's now implemented in hardware, even on commodity systems. It's, you know, Intel's chipsets all support AES instructions now. So AES is screamingly fast. So even 16,000 iterations isn't fast. But what's worse is the key used never changes across the entire user base, which means that all you have to do is take a dictionary of the 10,000 most common passwords, run them through this forward, since No one's key is ever different. We will get out the result, and now we have a lookup table for passwords. So this is just as bad as the long stand. I know.
That's as bad as you can get, really.
It's as bad as you can get. They've learned nothing from decades of experience with how to do this. You know, all the people that are using like unsalted SHA-1 to encrypt their passwords, and then the passwords get out and they're immediately broken because we have lookup tables now.
Right.
You know, reverse lookup tables for hashes. It's easy to create one because AES is so fast. It wouldn't even take the bad guys long to build the table. And then all you do is take someone's password and look it up here. You take the hashed result, look it up, and that reverses it for you. So it's a disaster. And then finally, and all they had to do was use something slow. Use Blowfish. Blowfish in Bcrypt was chosen because the key setup is so slow and there's no way to speed it up. So you use Blowfish with a key that changes every time, and it just grinds along. And so that's a much better choice than for some reason they just glommed onto AES and they used it everywhere. And even though you can use it right, they didn't.
It's a marketing term for them. We use AES everywhere, and that should make you feel better.
Yeah, actually, it is. Come to think of it, it's on all their pages.
Yeah.
And finally, it was noted by some people who signed up that the link you receive for email address confirmation is your user's hashed password and your encrypted master key. So it is what that means. And, of course, email is always sent in the clear, with very few exceptions. Certainly all of this email is. So anyone intercepting the confirmation email gets the user's hashed password to drop into this reverse lookup table that we just constructed a minute ago.
Then you have to run the tables.
And then you have the encrypted master key, which you can decrypt using that result. So you now have access to all the user's files.
Wow.
It's a catastrophe of mistakes. There is no reason to send all that information, the user's hashed password and their encrypted master key, to them as the confirmation link.
Right.
You know, send a random number. And when they click that, associate it with that stuff that you've held for a while. Maybe they're trying to do like stateless sign up. So they have no state at their end. They send everything.
I'm sure that's a higher priority for them given their current, you know, state of being under indictment.
Yeah.
The less they store, the better.
But then all they had to do is encrypt that with a key that only they know and then decrypt it when it comes back to them.
Right.
But they didn't do that. They left it unencrypted, the user's hashed password and the encrypted master key and other stuff in the link. Just nutty. So it's hard to understand. I mean, it's just full of holes. And then finally, this whole problem with dupe elimination that we talked about, they're doing, you know, we know that they're bragging about eliminating duplicates. I cannot see a way that that's safe for us, for users who might be storing data that anybody else would ever store. If we're storing photos and if we're storing our own videos or our own anything. I mean, 50 gigs is pretty tasty, you know, in terms of data.
Oh, yeah.
But if what you store ever matches what somebody else has stored, that information is there. Now, the individual file systems are encrypted in Mega's servers. So that it's probably not possible for the MPAA to say, tell us now all the people who have this. And as I understand it, you do send the whole file to Mega. What Mega could have done and this would have been a big mistake, would have been to hash it first. And we've talked about this in terms of TNO, cloud storage, and I think maybe it was Bitkasa, where Bitkasa didn't even bother to upload a file that it already had. Well, that is an instant giveaway to the recording industry, the copyright.
You got copies of this, eh?
Yeah, you already got it. Didn't need to send it to you.
It was instant.
Okay, we're going to go talk to our attorneys. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
So I think you have to send the file up.
Anyway.
So, yeah, anyway. So you don't. So the MPAA doesn't instantly know that there's already a copy of this online. But even so, somewhere there's got to be a what's called a reference count. That is, as somebody else uploads the same file, somewhere there's a counter that increments because they've got to know when it goes to zero that they can get rid of it. I mean, somewhere maybe if they just never flush the stuff, or if it ages and expires and disappears, or maybe they're just going to have infinite storage. But one would think they would do that. My point is that somewhere you are identified as being the owner of that file. And there is a notion of the group of people who own it. It may be that, I mean, we do understand that the file system is encrypted under the user's password and the master key that's created from that, so that only the user is able to decrypt their piece of the file system. But the mechanism is unclear. And it's not clear to me whether it wouldn't be possible to have a subpoena which says, this is a file we're sure your users have. We've uploaded it, and we want to subpoena the reference count. And it comes back, 10,000.
Yeah.
And they go, okay, fine. So 10,000 people have uploaded this file. You're telling us that because the file system is encrypted under their individual keys, you don't know who they are. So we found a judge who has issued a subpoena that will compel you to tell us who they are when they log in, because that's the point. When you log into Mega, you are decrypting your file system while you're there. And at that point, clear that the file is sitting there in your file tree architecture and it is known. So I can't see a way that it is safe to do this. Maybe when we know more about their back-end architecture, it'll become clear. I would, and we talked about this actually when we were talking about the problems, this kind of problem of dupe elimination. All you have to do is make some change to the file so that it's going to be different, and then it won't match, and you'll have your own, your own instance of it. Normally, there's a lot of junk up in the header that you could change. You could randomize, so it's not going to hash the same.
One bit is different. It doesn't matter how you know.
Yes.
Which, yeah.
I will say that I found it interesting that they're clearly browser centric at this point. I want to remind people that this is just the low friction, no client needed, use your browser to upload and download and browse and things. I am sure we're going to see, because they are being very open with their API to the back end, we will see Mega clients popping up fast. iOS, Windows, Linux, Mac, you name it. And many things get better then. That, all of this JavaScript problem, all of this authentication problem, I'm sure they've looked, I know because I've read their blogs, that they've looked at the criticism that they've received, and while they've sort of put up a good front, the fact is many of these critiques are correct, like the ones you just heard from me. There was a bunch of other stuff that was over the top, like, well, if SSL was broken, then it's like, well, okay, yes, and a meteor could hit the Earth too. So, let's not concern ourselves with that. But they, because they're browser-centric, Chrome is their favorite browser. It has, they talk about Chrome as the best browser for using Mega. And interestingly, IE10 is their second choice. Both Chrome, because both Chrome and IE10 have implemented the HTML5 file system interface. I've not looked at it, but clearly you need to somehow write files back to your file system that you got from your browser. Now, Firefox studiously avoids that. You know, it's never going to allow you to do that. I mean, that's really, you know, malware's dream come true. So
I'm surprised Chrome lets you do that.
I am too. There, you have to, like, you have to acknowledge it and say, yes, you're sure.
Oh, I know why. Like, it does it for Chrome OS and systems where you need to do that, because Chrome
and probably Google Docs too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's yeah, like, yeah. Google Drive, Docs, you're able to, you know, I'm able to do that.
Right.
So it's like, okay, let's hope this doesn't turn out badly. But I thought it was interesting that they like Chrome first and IE10 second, mostly because it's got support. They also said that IE10's Java just runs like a bat out of hell. They're really happy.
Yeah, they're using a good just-in-time renderer.
Yeah, so at this point, I read a recommendation that I liked a lot. Actually, it was the Spider Oak folks who, of course, they're in the same market, and so they were looking at the an astounding amount of interest that Mega was able to generate overnight. I mean, I'm sure you saw the numbers, Leo.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Millions, 5 million people in a few hours. They had hundreds of thousands, and they were, you know, some numbers of new accounts per second were being created. Anyway, the Spider Oak guys took a look at it and had some good commentary. I liked what they concluded. They said, given the startup problems, nothing which you have uploaded so far should be considered safe. So use it with caution now. And once these problems are fixed and known, fixed and confirmed, then scrap everything.
Start over.
Start over. Create a new account with new strong password. Oh, yeah. They said you also use a very strong bizarro from outer space password, because you don't want to fall victim to the 10,000 password dictionary reverse lookup, which somebody is doing as we speak right now. So use a crazy password. But when these problems are fixed, just start over. And consider everything you did before is no longer safe, because technically it's not. You know, I think they're trying to do the right thing, but this, you know, using the browser as sloppily as they have in order, you know, to come up with a zero friction solution, that it's just fraught with problems.
Hey, you mentioned salted hashes. And it made me think of a couple of security things that you didn't mention. Twitter was hacked. You probably saw that.
Maybe quarter million accounts.
First 250,000 users, which I'm one of them, so I got that email.
Kidding.
Yeah,
oh,
the
you
early
did get
users.
That.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
But those were salted and hashed. So probably not an issue if you used a good password, right?
I would think that's really true, Leo. Yes.
So just being prudent, letting people know, enforcing. They did force us to change our password. And then the other one, and you didn't mention this, but I thought it was kind of interesting, the file ... bug.
Yeah, well, I saw it go by, but I did not pursue it. What was it? Crashes OS 10 or something?
No, it doesn't crash the OS. It'll crash any app, pretty much. If you enter it in Chrome or Safari as a URL, it'll crash it. If you enter it as a file name, it'll crash. And apparently it's using some system library.
It just didn't expect three slashes.
Didn't expect that. Oh, it has to be capital FILE://
Wow.
But, and we mentioned this yesterday on MacBreak Weekly, well, all it does now is crash apps, as anybody who listens to Security Now knows. That's always the first step.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, just a couple of addenda.
Yeah, that's a crash in a bad place, too.
It is not good in the browser.
Well, and it's also in a field that's accepting data. Mm-hmm. So who knows if you created something wacky afterwards,
mm-hmm.
if that would like then? Crash it in a way that allows you to execute what's in the buffer that follows or something. Who knows?
Exactly.
I'm sure Apple will be on it.
Steve, yeah, it's kind of embarrassing, frankly. It's a long-standing bug that nobody knew about. Steve, always a pleasure. This show, we do this show every Wednesday at 11 a.m.
Pacific. Whatever
the hell day this is. 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. If you want to watch live, the chat room is always a great resource for both me and Steve. Somebody asked a question in the chat room, and I had to say, you know, Steve is in the middle of a conversation, but in general, he does not answer questions from the chat room because he likes to research and come up with the definitive, canonical answer to any question. But there is a way to ask him questions, and next week we will answer questions by going to grc.com/feedback, and Steve will pick 10 or so questions from the list and answer those.
And maybe we'll even get to them.
This time. Yeah, we missed a few last week.
We did four last time.
Yeah.
But that's because, I mean, it was not like...
There was news.
You know, we didn't have enough to talk about. We still delivered an hour and a half of great content. So that's really our goal.
And we were explaining this week, you know, kind of more about the UPnP issue. And, of course, SpinRight. I'm sorry. I always say SpinRight instead of Shields Up. SpinRight's the great program Steve makes and encourage you to buy, because that's his bread and butter, really the only thing he charges for right now, and that's at grc.com. It's the best hard drive maintenance utility out there. There's nothing even close. But also Shields Up, which is his free service he's had for many years. You said you hadn't touched the code since 2009? 2006? Been a while.
It's been, it was about 10 years, actually.
Wow, 2003.
Oh, we're at 790. So three more people have found exposures of their routers since the last 787.
Is there a short URL to go to for that?
No, there's really not.
Just go to grc.com and run Shields Up.
And go Shields Up, yeah. And then you find you can't miss it once you go there. I write my code to last. And I hadn't looked at it in a decade. Or I should say I hadn't looked at that aspect, but, you know, I've written other code to do, you know, related things like the perfect paper, like the perfect paper password support, the DNS spoofability test, you know, other aspects of that. But that particular area, the Shields Up stuff, has just been cruising along with no problems, much like SpinRight itself that is due for an update. And as soon as I catch up with my other loose ends, I'm going to do that.
grc.com. That's the place to go. You can follow Steve on Twitter at sggrc. He tweets all week with links and so forth, and that's a good place to post queries or more like informational updates to him, because he does read the at replies to at sggrc. You can also get 16 kilobit audio versions of the show there for people with bandwidth constraints or your hearing that just can't tell the difference, transcripts, which makes it really easy to follow along. If you want a slightly higher quality audio or video, get that from us, twit.tv/SN.
And now we're on YouTube with youtube.com/securitynow.
Yeah. So that's a good way. You can watch the video on YouTube. We certainly count that. You know, that's part of our counting. And, you know, we prefer you subscribe if you can in iTunes or a Downcast or some other client. But if you want to watch on YouTube, you can do that. And you can even subscribe at that point and get an email every time there's a new episode posted on YouTube. That's at youtube.com/security. Steve, we'll see you next Wednesday.
Sounds good.
On Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Security Now.